This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stachow. Comic book readers have avidly followed the stories of their favorite superheroes for decades. But take a closer look, and you'll find that comics are often about much more than just fighting crime in a cape. Over the years, they've explored complex messages about politics, society, and identity. And these themes have translated to the comics' movie adaptations. Here's a clip from this year's Black Panther.
It's about 2 billion people all over the world that looks like us, but their lives are a lot harder. Wakanda has the tools to liberate them all.
And what tools are those?
Vibranium. Your weapons.
Our weapons will not be used to wage war on the world. It is not our way to be judge, jury, and executioner for people who are not our own.
Not your own. But didn't life start right here on this continent? So ain't all people your people?
I am not king of all people. I am king of Wakanda.
That's a clip from the Marvel movie Black Panther. So it's not just superhero comics that give a social commentary. Graphic novels also have a long history of delivering diverse and nuanced narratives. What should readers look for in a comic or graphic novel, and how does it differ from other types of literature? We'll have that conversation today. Joining me first is Margaret Simon. She's an English professor at NC State University who studies comics and graphic novels. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'd love for you to start by talking about this form. What is it that makes comics and graphic novels unique? What is it about this combination of visuals and texts coming together?
I think that the main message that I try to convey when I teach in this medium is that the illustrations and the visual text on the page is really making an argument about the subject at hand. It's not kind of an illustration in the way that you might think about a typical children's book or other illustrated text. The image is really doing the work of creating meaning and creating an argument in concert with the written text.
So unlike cinema, where you're a passive spectator, you have to be sort of actively interpreting how these images and words are coming together.
I think that's true. I think it does require a certain amount of attention, and that can be challenging. I mean, I think you don't necessarily have to give it that attention. I always want people to feel like this is an accessible medium and one that is fun to read as well. But if you do have time and you do take the time to really dissect the panels, you can, really advance your understanding of the text in a way that people might not expect.
So Superman and Batman weren't the first things to combine images and text. Tell me about the deep history. You say it goes back to woodcutting.
I mean, it goes back further than that, but certainly for print in the West, you could go, all the way back to 14th century block books. When I teach the class, I actually start with an 18th century engraver, William Hogarth, who did a lot of very kind of wry social commentary using his prints with a very kind of minimal amount of text going along with it. And then we sometimes move forward to William Blake, who was himself a printer. He's a late 18th century poet. And just to give students this sense that even though comics feel really now, they are something that has been fascinating people for centuries.
And Blake, I looked into this after hearing that you researched it. He illustrated Dante's Divine Comedy. And so tell me about sort of how he is an interesting example of how illustration can comment on aspects of a text that we may have not considered before.
Well, I might actually take you just in a slightly different direction, if that's okay. I think that what's really important about Blake is that he actually innovates on the whole printing process and becomes an artist and a writer at the same time, not dissimilar from someone we might also talk about today, like Alison Bechtel or also Hope, who's with us today, and is both an artist and a writer. And that, to me, is what is exciting about Blake's work, is that he is a writer who undertook to learn printmaking to really enliven his own texts.
So how did comics as something sold separately outside of the context of a newspaper, for example, become a thing?
I would say that we might trace that back to kind of the earliest Superman comics, which would be Action Comics in the 1930s. And that really starts the kind of era of Superman comics being superhero comics being kind of a standalone thing. Although, I mean, newspaper comics continue, as you know, even today. And then I would kind of maybe put another bookend to the kind of Superman concept about 50 years later with the emergence of Watchmen by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons, which kind of becomes a really standalone collection that is very much a comic book, but it, because of the way that it's marketed and sold, it's almost sold in the form of a novel.
Well, tell me about that. So we mentioned at the top the art form is portrayed in both comics and graphic novels. But can you distinguish the two? Are they two separate things, comics and graphic novels?
Oh, gosh. I really do find that a really challenging. Sometimes I think that's an increasingly challenging differentiation to make. I think that comics historically have been kind of more overtly interested in kind of external actions and politics and being really kind of in their moment, whereas graphic novels sometimes take more of an interest in memoir and kind of looking inside different individual stories. In terms of the art style, that is a little bit of a harder question to answer. I mean, I think that the kind of color palettes that you see in traditional comics do somewhat differentiate them from the very much more quirky and individual styles that you'll see in different graphic novels. But I don't know that there's a really hard and fast separation.
Well, you mentioned
today, at least.
Well, you mentioned this sort of intersection of the personal and political, and looking at the internal life of a character as being a defining feature of a graphic novel. Tell me about how maybe Mouse as an example of a graphic novel that really brought this medium to the forefront and shows off what it is possible of doing.
Yes, Mouse is a great example. And I actually just have to mention, I don't know if people saw, but today Sabrina, and I hope I'm not going to mispronounce the author's name, by Nick Dernasso, got nominated for the Man Booker Prize in the main fiction category. It's the first time a graphic novel has held that position.
Wow.
So that's interesting relative to Mouse, who was, which was the first graphic text to win a Pulitzer in 1992. So it's interesting to kind of have that have happened today. And, of course, John Lewis's civil rights memoir, March, the third volume, won the National Book Award in 2016. So those are all three texts that I would put as kind of at the foreground of advancing graphic novels to a broader audience. But, yes, Mouse was written originally as a comic for Art Spiegelman's underground comic called Raw, and it was then serialized and became kind of a very hefty two-volume set that recounts his experience of interviewing his dad and learning his father's experiences in the Holocaust. And I think what is really profound about Mouse is that it uses a lot of the conventions of traditional comics, like the characters are created as animals. The Germans are pigs, and the Jewish people are mice. And there's a kind of a way that is kind of playing with the concept of traditional comics, but it's telling this really profound, personal, very political, very emotional, and often violent story, which we're not necessarily expecting from that medium.
Well, yeah, as you described, being able to characterize things that we think we know really well through a different image, like a cat or a mouse, gives us the ability to reimagine what's possible, reimagine how we have perceived specific historical events. And this leads me to sort of thinking about gender and gender representation in comics and graphic novels. Can you talk a little bit about how women have been depicted and what's interesting about that to you?
Well, you know, I think that it's been a kind of a back and forth. I don't think that we've seen like an exact progression where, you know, women were poorly depicted in early comics and have easily, you know, we've easily rectified that. There's been a lot of back and forth in the portrayal of women in comics. And as we were kind of preparing for this show, I was revisiting Jackie Orms's work on Torchy Brown. She's well recognized as kind of the first African-American woman comic writer. And her depictions of women were incredibly fashionable, incredibly forward-thinking. Her character, Torchy, travels internationally. She battles racial and environmental injustice. And this is all in the 1940s and the 1950s, which is, I think, probably surprising to some people. But along the way, we've also, of course, seen the kind of traditional portrayal of women in very scantily clad costumes that really don't seem to give them much of an opportunity to fight crime if they're in a superhero situation. And so there's really been a lot of back and forth. But I think one of the more interesting characters within this, and most people would talk probably about Wonder Woman, but another interesting character is actually Miss Marvel, because Miss Marvel initially was created to as a sort of foil for Captain Marvel, the male Captain Marvel, and eventually herself becomes Captain Marvel in 2012 and is now the kind of advisor to the new Miss Marvel, Kamala Khan, who is a Palestinian American. And her new story allows us to see a woman kind of navigating her own cultural position within America in a really interesting way that feels very relevant to 2018.
Great. Well, we will continue this conversation just ahead. I'm speaking with Maggie Simon, an English professor at NC State University. And joining us will be an author and illustrator who creates comics and graphic novels, as well as a professor who has co-created a graphic novel to educate people about the prison system. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. We're talking about the history and culture of comics and graphic novels today. What lies between the panels, and how do comics and graphic novels showcase diverse stories about society and politics? Still with me is Maggie Simon. She's an English professor at NC State University. So before the break, we were talking about representations of gender in comics and graphic novels, and there are many more women who are authoring these today, which gives unique opportunities for self-representation. Maybe you can tell me about Fun Home by Alison Bechdel as an example of a comic memoir and what she is doing in this that you think is interesting.
Absolutely. And I should say that I misspoke earlier that Kamala Khan and Miss Marvel is a Pakistani-American. I apologize for that. Fun Home is just a really, really, really complicated and fascinating text in terms of its strategy for trying to tell of using the memoir format for the character Allison, who is Alison Bechdel, to tell the kind of the story of herself to herself. And I think that what is happening in that text that's really fascinating is that she is very set on portraying herself as she is, which is someone who is very intellectual. She reads a lot. If you're reading this book for the first time, you might feel frustrated because she has so many references to different myths and literary characters and books that you might not be familiar with. And that can be kind of off-putting. But I think that the reason that Bechdel tells her story in this way is so that people see that being yourself and whatever that might be, as quirky as it might be, is ultimately your kind of universal message. That's her strategy for kind of actualizing herself. And it's something that her father, who lives closeted and meets a very ambiguous end, I don't want to totally give away the whole story, is not able to do. And I feel like the book is sort of trying to allow her to redo some of the things her father was not able to do in his life.
Yeah, it's incredibly dense. I remember having to look up a variety of names of psychoanalysts throughout history alongside reading it. But I mean, so she is a woman who is exploring her own gender through writing this book. And I wonder, what is it about this form that allows different portrayals of communities that may not have as much of a voice? How does this form allow them to express themselves differently than traditional prose, do you think?
Right. And that's a really important point, I think, about graphic memoir and graphic novels more broadly. And I think that Hilary Shute, who's a scholar of graphic novels, says it best when she talks about the way that graphic memoir and graphic novels can help to make trauma visible in ways that we might not expect traditional text to be able to do. So you can kind of represent through two different modes, through written text and through the visual, your experience. And maybe by having that multiplicity, you can arrive at more insight. And I think that that is a really powerful thing. And Bechdel's own process is really fascinating. I mean, she actually positions herself, takes pictures of herself, and then draws herself as the characters in her book. So it's also a very intimate, I think, process. And I'd be interested to hear the processes of the folks we're going to talk with today as well.
Well, perfect segue. You did my work for me. Joining the conversation now is Hope Larson. She is an Asheville-based author and illustrator whose new graphic novel is called All Summer Long. It tells the story of a teenager living in L.A. navigating the challenges of adolescence. Hope also wrote an adaptation of the famous novel A Wrinkle in Time, as well as several issues of Batgirl for DC Comics. Hope joins me now from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back.
Last time you were on, you talked a bit about your interest in manga, which are comics created in Japan or by creators in Japanese. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about manga and the sort of global conversation that happens around comics. They're obviously not just an American art form.
Sure. When I was in high school, I really got hardcore into comics through manga. They were just not like anything that I'd seen before. You read them backwards. There are all these little visual shorthands for different emotions, like a sweat drop on somebody's forehead if they're nervous. Stuff I'd just never seen before. And I loved decoding those and feeling like I was in the club and learning this new language. Those were really my bridge into indie comics and superhero comics and all the domestic comics as well.
As a creator, what opportunities does this form allow you that you wouldn't have if you were just illustrating or just writing?
Maggie actually touched on the way that the illustrations and text work together in comics. And for me, that's really true. Like, I love that synthesis of images and words and how the images are adding to and propping up what the words are saying, or sometimes subverting them and undercutting them. Like, you've got two things happening at the same time in a single panel, which is pretty cool.
Well, walk me through how you do this. So thinking about A Wrinkle in Time, for example, a 200 and some page novel.
It's 400.
It's 400. Okay.
Yeah.
So how do you figure out what you're going to draw versus what you're going to write and how you're going to put the two things together? What is your process like?
Well, generally, I try to include as little text as I can, because any words that you're putting on the page are taking up space that you could use for the illustration. For A Wrinkle in Time, I was mostly trying to be as faithful as possible to the novel itself, because I grew up with the book and I wanted to do it justice. I mostly just wanted to take the images that are in the book and get them down on paper, and then use the dialogue as in the speech balloons. So that's pretty much how that worked.
And in terms of examining the internal world, we spoke a little bit with Maggie about how this form allows you to get insight into what the character is thinking, a little bubble from their head, and you see the trajectory of their thoughts. How do you do that kind of internal world exploration in your work?
A lot of it is done visually for me. It's the expressions on the characters' faces, their physical acting, the way they're moving around a space. You can see a lot of what's in their head in the way that they're expressing themselves visually. I try not to do a ton of speech balloons and internal monologue type stuff, because I think it can really take you out of the story a little bit, but I do include some, because sometimes that's the only way to get the specificity that you need in that moment in the story.
So your newest graphic novel, All Summer Long, tells the story of a teenager who's becoming more interested in music. It's geared toward middle grade readers. What is it about this form that you think works well for middle grade readers or young adults?
Well, it's a great format for kids who are maybe not connecting with reading. Maybe prose is intimidating to them. They can come to comics and they can relate to the images and then read a little bit less prose and gain the confidence to read more. What I always tell parents is that A Wrinkle in Time, the graphic novel, has almost all of the text that's in the novel itself. So if a kid can get through that, and a lot of the time they can, they've basically read the novel.
Hmm. Maggie, I know that you teach students in your classes who maybe don't have a lot of familiarity with graphic novels. And upon first glance, it can be a little bit overwhelming. There's a lot going on the page. How do you suggest that people approach these if they're unfamiliar?
I think that probably depends on what context you're approaching them in. I mean, if you're just reading them for fun, I would say just, you know, read them for fun and don't feel pressured to kind of unpack every single panel. But, you know, do notice the panels and maybe just occasionally try to linger over something that catches your eye, just as you might linger over a description in a traditional novel. I think that the key is to just be relaxed. I feel like when my students get kind of anxious is when they're feeling really compelled to just look at absolutely every little thing, and that can be overwhelming, especially in a text like Bechdel's, or, you know, we could think of a lot of other examples where there's a lot of detail in the page.
It's funny because as kids, maybe that comes really naturally to us to learn and think about narrative in a more visual way, but then as we get older and move towards strictly prose, it's almost harder to flip back.
And yeah, I think that absolutely. Students don't always think that it's that is real work. I don't know, Hope, if you sometimes struggle with, like you were saying, you have to get the parents to, you know, believe that they're really reading the novel this way.
Yeah, well, you know what's so cool is that when I started out working with book publishers and doing graphic novels, there was a lot of pushback from librarians and from teachers who just didn't see comics as real books or graphic novels as real books. And that has really gone away. And librarians and teachers are some of the greatest mm-hmm. champions that comics has as a medium right now. And we're in this real new golden age of comic books, I think, especially for younger readers.
I would like to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. Jamie Markham is a professor at the UNC School of Government who focuses on criminal law and procedure. He recently co-created a graphic novel about the prison system to help educate people about its rules and procedures. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about the philosophy behind graphic novels, maybe that you can amplify a certain message through simplifying it and distilling it in a particular form. Tell me about why you chose this form to look at the prison system and give people who are listening a sense of what the product is that you created.
Sure. It is a comic. It's called In Prison, Serving a Felony Sentence in North Carolina. I wrote most of the words in it, and the artist is a man named Jason Whitley, who also works over at UNC. And another collaborator is Shane Therrington. He actually works for the prison system, and he helped me make sure, I had all my facts straight about what, you know, what I was trying to depict of what things are really going to be like within the prison system. But the purpose of it, I mean, the mission of the School of Government is to improve the lives of all North Carolinians. We do a lot of that work in working with public officials. Like, a lot of my teaching is for judges and prosecutors and lawyers. But we also do it for citizens and the citizens of North Carolina. And this was, I think my colleagues are really good at practical scholarship that is accessible. We do that in all sorts of different ways, whether it's just our traditional writing or in electronic scholarship like blogs. We've had YouTube channels and other things. So this is kind of a continuation of that tradition of experimenting and trying different ways to take the same content, some of which, you know, can be somewhat difficult or confusing as far as legal topics, and try to present it in a way that is as accessible as possible to, you know, in this case, to defendants, to inmates who might find themselves in the prison system, or to victims who, you know, might have been the victim of a crime and want to know what's going to happen in the case, how long the defendant might be in prison, or their family members, particularly young people, that this might be a way they can access that information.
And you really break down each aspect of the process to humanize what it's like to go through this experience. You see in one of the first panels a judge saying your sentence could be between 10 and 24 months. I'm making those numbers
right.
up.
No,
but a large range. And then you see the individual hearing that and thinking, you know, each of those months is 30 days. That's clearly a long time. I'm going to be away from my family. Can you talk about, I mean, was it intentional to humanize the process of being in the prison system?
Well, that you're exactly right. Sort of as, you know, North Carolina's sentencing law is really formulaic. If you watch court any day, you would hear those combinations of numbers thrown out all the time. It's, you know, 10 to 21 or 6 to 17 and 8 to 19, that those numbers go hand in hand just in the way the math of the system works. But you're absolutely right. It's not clear to the person, particularly if it's their first time through the system, what that means. You know, 10 and 21 are two very different numbers, and they would very reasonably want to know, like, hey, is it going to be closer to 10 or 21? Because those are about a year apart. And likewise for the victim of the crime to know, like, hey, when will I see this person again in the community? Just to know what, you know, whatever your sense of the justice of the whole situation, just to know the facts about what it means and to make informed decisions about it. So that is where it picks up. It sort of goes from that moment where the judge pronounces the sentence in court and just shows all the things that happen, in my sense, is sort of typically behind the scenes from the, you know, if we've all been driving out on the interstates and seen the inmate transfer buses moving inmates around the state to different prisons in the system. It follows that this one defendant through that chronology from the moment the sentence is pronounced until he, in this case, is ultimately released.
As someone deeply rooted in the world of law and criminal procedure, what were the challenges of writing this in a way that was more simplified and more accessible?
Well, just like your other guests have said, some of it is space limitations. And so, you know, as lawyers sort of take for granted that we could just keep writing and writing. But here, you know, when you have, you know, Jason's artwork and you really want that to be the centerpiece of it, I recognize pretty quickly, like, look, I can't write forever. The font's a little bit bigger than what I'm used to. There's no footnotes. And so it really forced me to strip it down to the most essential and clearest way I could state things. And I think it was better because of it. Actually, it was a really nice reminder to me and probably to, you know, any others in professions that get paid by the word that sometimes less can be more. So to let the artwork shine and try to keep it as clear as possible was an enjoyable process for me.
One of the things that really stood out to me too was the different kinds of representation of who is inside the prison system. I saw a woman who appeared to be a middle-aged white woman. I saw a woman who appeared to be more of the age of a grandmother. I saw a variety of different body shapes and sizes, people of different backgrounds. I wonder about how you all talked about how to represent who the system affects and how that comes through in the graphic novel.
Sure. You know, Jason and I mean, Shane obviously works and has worked in the Department of Public Safety for a long time. So he has a very good sense, has spent, you know, time working in the prison system for a long time. But Jason and I went and visited, and I take groups on tours of prisons all the time. And so have a sense of that you see people from all walks of life in there, and just didn't want to shy away from any of that. That it's, you know, most of the people in the prison system are not serving life sentences. They're going to be back in the community, and so just to give this window into what their lives are like while they're there was part of our goal.
Hope, can you talk a little bit about representation in your work and how you think about what you want your viewers to see, the actual images of the people you want them to see when they open up your book?
Sure. Yeah. I tried the All Summer Long is set in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles is a very diverse city, and I wanted to reflect that. I wanted to show people of different races and different sexualities. There isn't a lot of, it's not super specific, but you can just look at the people in the book and see that there's a range of different kinds of people depicted.
Maggie, I don't have a lot of time left, but you alluded earlier to the kind of literary recognition that this art form is now getting. And what argument would you make for why graphic novels and comics should be considered alongside some of the really important pieces of prose text that many of us grew up reading in our high school English class?
I mean, I think that the most basic argument isn't really an argument at all, which is that they are literature. They are telling important, relevant, sometimes beautiful, sometimes difficult, sometimes informative stories, just like any book that you would pick up. They're just doing it in a way that is maybe a little bit less familiar. But in terms of a broader argument, in terms of the way that we're kind of trying to teach young people now, I think that, you know, we are in a very visual world, and all of us are bombarded on a regular basis with all kinds of combinations of text and image. Like, you can even just think of the last meme somebody, you know, posted on your Instagram. And being able to interpret the way that text and image are working together is, I think, really important to being media literate in today's culture. And these books, while they're not all geared towards political or current events, are kind of honing your skill at doing that. And I think that that's a really important kind of broader rationale for teaching them.
Well, I wish I had more time. Maggie Smith is an English professor at NC State University who studies comics and graphic novels. Hope Larson is an Asheville-based graphic novelist whose new work is called All Summer Long. And Jamie Markham is a professor at the UNC School of Government who recently created a graphic novel to educate people about the prison system, has others in the works. We will stay tuned. Thanks so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
There's more just ahead. Please stay with us.